Come down here. The Greek woman dead? Was she really? Or was this just some sort of police trick to get them to move on, or give up their cards?
I don't know what you're talking about, Nuritin said.
She was an archaeologist, Beekman said. A Greek. Nuritin shrugged. She used to come here sometimes, with her friends, and distribute food.
We don't know anything about her, Nuritin said.
He saw Beekman look at Emine. Then he heard him say, she'd just given birth to a child when she died. It's in this city somewhere. We need to find it, soon.
Emine put a hand up to her face.
A baby?
Do you know where Ariadne's baby might be? Beekman asked. Just newborn?
Oh, Allah! I didn't know she was pregnant,
Emine said.
Nuritin was furious that she'd fallen for the policeman's lies.
Shut up, woman! You don't know what you're talking about!
He turned to Beekman.
We don't know of any such woman.
Yes, we do, Emine insisted.
The woman is delusional, he said. She talks nonsense.
Emine hit him.
Delusional? Me?
She turned to Beekman.
I apologize for him, Beefindi, she said. He's old and crazy, and he's missing a leg. Ariadne Hanum is very dear to us. She has tried to help people here. Why is she dead? What has happened to her?
We think she may have been murdered, Beekman said. Emine began to weep.
Oh, the monster, she said.
She hid Nuritin again, and then crouched down on her haunches to cry. Accusatory black eyes powered into Nuritin's soul.
All right, we knew her, he admitted.
Ariadne Sava.
Yes. We live by picking up rubbish, we always have, he said. There's no dishonor in that. At least there wasn't until we all got evicted from our homes and the bulldozers moved in. When you are homeless, you cease to exist. You become a squatter and a pariah. But that Greek lady knew better. She knew that when the police arrested us for vagrancy, they were going to take our carts and then make us pay to get them back. You know about that, do you?
I do.
She argued with the police and with the bastard who created all this mess here in Gizli Tepe, and I don't mean our landlord.
He means Ahmed Erden,
Emine said. Was it wise for her to tell an unknown policeman about that? Nuritin wondered. But then did it really matter now? Erden had taken their homes and had them chased from pillar to post. What was there left for him to do? And Nuritin was sad about Ariadne. She'd been a nice lady.
Ahmed Erden threatened Ariadne if she kept on helping us,
Emine said. Threatened her? How?
He said that if she carried on coming here, he'd make her sorry. He's capable of anything. He even beats his own men. If you're looking for Ariadne's baby, you'd better start searching his house.
Are you sure that Ariadne was pregnant?
Yes.
Nuritin shook his head.
Such things can happen.
And then he saw that Beekman was being joined by two more, this time uniformed, police officers.
Nuritin narrowed his eyes. What's this? He said.
We'll need to search the area, Beekman said. He offered Nuritin a cigarette, which he thought about taking, and then refused.
Why do you need to search?
Nuritin said. For the baby.
Then why look here? He said. We told you. We didn't know that Ariadne was pregnant. Why would we have her baby here in all this filth we have to live in anyway?
I don't know, Beekman said. But you knew her, and so we have to do it. He ordered the two uniformed constables into the rubble and dirt that represented all that was left of old Gizli Tepe.
That bastard Ahmed Erden knew her too,
Emine yelled.
But you won't search his great mansion out of Bebek, will you?
I will if it's necessary, Beekman said. I am aware, madam, that the worst villains in the world live in nice clean houses and wear suits. I may be many things, but I'm nobody's fool. Not sleeping didn't work for Kerim Gürsel. First, he'd had to watch Sinem when she took her medication, and then he'd been distracted by the comings and goings to and from Gezi Park in the early hours of the morning.
More people had arrived, and then more police. Sinem had never taken such a high dose of pain control before. Her doctor had left instructions at the pharmacy to call him if her breathing became labored. It hadn't, but Kerim had been worried. She was only 38, and already the arthritis he'd always known her to have was threatening to push her over into a drug dependency he knew she'd hate. Now he was with a man he suspected felt just as helpless as he. Mr. Abdul Hamid Akar was a senior official at the offices of Kadıköy Municipality. But he was a man who clearly knew the limits of his power. When developers move in, single municipalities have limited power over firstly what they buy and secondly what they build, he said. Privately owned land, such as that in Gizli Tepe district, can be bought and sold freely. But surely you, as the local authority, have the power to enforce local planning regulations? Kerim said. Indeed. He adjusted his glasses. We will oversee new development. The plans submitted conform to our regulations, so far. And yet a proportion of the population in Gizli Tepe have been made homeless. Sadly, yes. There was an awkward pause, and then he said, Sergeant, it is a sad fact of life that when a municipality is subject to the higher authority of a city government, we cannot always get what we want, or fulfill the expectations of our residents. So, a great many people in Kadıköy do not want our famous Haydarpaşa railway station to be developed into a hotel, Akar said. The city of Istanbul, on the other hand, thinks that it is an excellent idea. If I am being realistic, and in light of our redevelopment plans that have come to fruition in the city, I imagine that many people of Kadıköy will be disappointed. Do you understand what I mean? Yes. Kerim knew there was a political dimension, too. Kadıköy being under the auspices of one party, while the city of Istanbul was under that of another. However, I take your point about the rubbish pickers of Gizli Tepe. A provision has not been... Mr. Akka, did you ever come across the woman who, we believe, became their advocate? Kerim asked. Ariadne Sava? Not personally, but I knew of her, Akar said. How? He smiled. Via the complaints of colleagues, he said. This lady was making some legitimate points about issues we could do nothing about. You know the rubbish collectors, a few in number, and they choose to stay where they are. Where else can they go? Unless they try to find somewhere, how will they know? Maybe they've tried to find somewhere and failed. Mr. Akar smiled. Suddenly Kerim didn't like him as much as he thought he did. You know, Sergeant, he said, between the demands of the very rich and the cries of the poor, we find ourselves between a rock and a hard place. We do our best, but if people will not move along gracefully... He opened his arms in a helpless gesture. Unfortunately, we cannot always have what we want. Kerim didn't feel that having somewhere to live was an unreasonable want, but he said nothing. Mr. Akar was a man under pressure, which meant that he was like 90% of local government officials. He wondered what he made of the Gezi Park situation, and decided that he would probably be very non-committal on the subject. Both French windows were open, so he could make the most of the breeze coming in from the Bosphorus. Out on the balcony, he watched Kelime play with her dolls. Ahmet Erdin smiled. He knew people wondered how he coped with her on his own, but she was such a good girl, and he had Mary for the more unpleasant tasks. He looked again at the plans the architect had submitted for a radical new apartment block in Kadıköy. He'd thought it was very innovative, until the English nanny had seen it.
"Oh, Mr. Erdin," Mary had said, "that looks just like the Shard of Glass in London."
She'd googled it for him, his well-spoken English nanny, and he'd seen that what she had told him was quite true. His architect's building looked almost identical to what was now apparently the tallest building in London. Why did people always try to cheat him? Did they think he was a fool? Ahmet Erdin was an Istanbulu born and bred. His family, who had lived in Eminönü for generations, had been poor. For 15 years after he'd left primary school, He'd worked mainly with his father in every low-waged, manual job he could find. The city had offered many temptations, and he could have turned to crime on several occasions, but he hadn't. His father, Taha, whom some had called a bigot, had been a religious man, and so Ahmed had known that the pious life was the only option for him from an early age. He'd accepted his lot, married a pious Muslim girl, Kelime's mother, and busied himself promoting the notion of moderate Islamic government. He'd never imagined that his beliefs would become mainstream. But in 2002, when the Islamically rooted AK Party had come to power, Ahmed's political dreams came true. In the 3 years that followed that victory, he got in with a group of like-minded Islamic movers and shakers, and eventually he managed to start a small building company of his own. He'd worked on building sites for years. He was eloquent and pious, and so it wasn't hard for him to persuade people to invest. Also, then, he had wanted to build low-cost, decent housing for poor but observant people, like his parents. And then, finally, Lale, his wife, had got pregnant, and for the first time in his life, Ahmed felt content. The memory of it made Ahmed's smile fade. It had been obvious that Kelime had not been right from the moment of her birth. Tiny and limp, her mouth had been fat and her eyes had slanted upwards like, as Ahmed had put it, a Chinese person. One of his new friends got the couple an appointment with a pediatrician who told them that Kelime had Down's syndrome. She was bad, apparently, and would need 24-hour care. Lale had just cried, but Ahmed had been like stone. Unwilling to allow himself to feel, he'd poured all of his energies into finding ways he could make the money he would need to give his daughter everything a normal child would want, and more. He watched her play, and then when she looked up, he waved. Kelime had every Barbie doll that could be bought in Turkey. She loved them all, and never tired of making up stories about them. He heard her chattering, holding each doll up to her face and smiling. At 12, Kelime was overweight, in spite of Nanny Mary's efforts to make her walk more. She loved ice cream, and so he gave her every flavor that existed. Just because he couldn't have it, it didn't mean his daughter should be denied. Mary had gently told him off. Apparently, the diabetes he suffered from could be inherited, and eating lots of high-fat, sugary food made that more likely. But Ahmed had told Mary that she was a nanny, not a nurse, and he didn't pay her such a huge salary to criticize him. Mary had shut up. When he finally decided to take a new wife, distant though that was, Ahmed had promised himself that he would sack the English nanny and get a cheaper local woman. She wouldn't have the same cachet as the English woman, but Ahmed had already made his point about his wealth to anyone who mattered years before. Kelime's condition had only crystallized a greed Ahmed had always known he had. Once he'd completed the social housing project, he'd looked for other clients of a different sort. As his developments became more and more elaborate, so his charges increased. His influence grew. There were elaborate dinners, men only, no alcohol, and charitable activities around education and support for the poor. Lale had been left alone with Kelime during that time. Ahmed knew she found it hard. He watched her get thin, fall into silence, and wander the house at night talking to herself like a sad ghost. One day, when her mother took Kelime out in her buggy for a few hours, Lale drank a bottle of disinfectant. And as soon as he'd buried his wife, Ahmed worked even harder. Now he was a multimillionaire, which meant that he and Kelime could have whatever they wanted. A much younger version of Ahmed walked into the room and said, "You've heard about these protests in Biolu?"
"Yes."
"What do you think?" Simi Erdin was 15 years younger than his brother. Dressed in tight jeans and a designer T-shirt, he looked a lot like some of the young environmentalists who were still, in spite of police efforts, gathering in Gezi Park. "I think it will pass," Ahmed said. "People want to shop. Look at all the malls in this city." "Of course they do. What use is a park?"
"I don't know. Some of them look a bit crazy, but maybe they have a point.
Like what? This country will never go back to what it was before, Ahmed said. They're just making a fuss because they're not at the top of the tree anymore. Forget it. We've got more important things to think about.
Simi looked at Kelime, absorbed in her dolls.
Ahmed nudged him and gave him an envelope.
What's this?
My latest offer to the Negropontes, Ahmed said. Returned, unopened.
You know they don't want to sell. I don't know why you bother with it.
You know exactly why. Simi turned away. And that plot could be very lucrative, Ahmed said. Right in the middle of Sultan Ahmed. I could build a hotel to rival the Four Seasons.
Couldn't you do that, using the existing building?
It seems to me it's a nice house, and no, why do you even ask? You know why.
Simi shrugged.
Ahmed said, I can make something new and individual. Those old houses are a fire risk, and they cost a fortune to equip with the kind of technology billionaire guests will expect.
But space is so limited in that area, Simi said. I don't know why you don't build something here or in Yeniköy. Give them phosphor fuse. They can moor their yachts.
Simi, you disapprove. Ahmed said, I've got that. But you're young. You don't really remember your father. Trust me and the memory of our father on this. This was his dream. It's my job to fulfill that. Be my brother. Do your job, and I will always take care of you.
His brother said nothing.
It was his way of backing down, and Ahmed knew it.
Ahmed Erdin stood up and took back the envelope he'd given to his brother.
I'm going to have that site, whether the Negropontes like it or not, he said. The man says his family have been in this city for over 1,000 years. Well, that's long enough. It's now time for them to leave.
A knock on Ahmed's office door was followed by the appearance of a small, headscarfed woman.
Ahmed Bey, there is a policeman here to see you,
the maid said. A policeman? Why?
He says he needs to speak to you, Bey Effendi.
Ahmed waved a hand. Tell him I'm out, he said. Tell him if he wants to speak to me, he'll have to wait. The girl left.
Police?
Simi queried. What have you been doing, brother? Anything I should know?
No.
I live a good life, Simi, as well you know. If I won't or can't talk to the police, then that is because I choose not to. The days of jumping to attention every time one of my betters calls me are over. I'll complain. Now I do what I want, what I think is best, and what is written I must do.
Çetin İkmen felt as if he was back at school. He wondered whether Kerim Gürsel, shuffling uneasily from foot to foot and knitting his own fingers, felt the same.
You have to make an appointment to see Mr. Erdin, Commissioner Tekel said. You can't just arrive.
İkmen and Gürsel had only just returned to the station from Ahmed Erdin's house in Bebek.
So if he wasn't in, how come he's complaining to you now? İkmen asked. How did he know I went to his house if he was, as I was told, out?
His staff told him, apparently, Tekel said.
Then she shook her head.
Listen, İkmen, Gürsel, we all know what Mr. Erdin is.
An arrogant,
a man of some force, she said, and also someone who is very powerful. If, as you say, İkmen, he had a run-in with the late Ariadne Sava, then he may well have wished her harm. I do not buy into his holy image, so don't worry about that. But would he kill her over a few derelicts in Kadıköy?
No, of course not, İkmen said, but that child is still missing.
Or dead.
Or dead, he said, and Erdin has a connection. I'm only doing my job, madam.
Erdin Tekke sat down behind her desk. İkmen could still see her predecessor, Ardıç, sitting there sometimes. Fat, sweaty, and world-weary, he'd always tried to do his best. And Tekke, thankfully, seemed to be the same.
I know, İkmen, she said, and I commend you for it. But we have to tread carefully with people like Erdin, especially at the moment.
Gezi, she looked up at Gürsel.
The park is quiet now, but people are still gathering, and I fear it may all start up again if the authorities don't back down over this mole. Which they won't, she said. And we are on their side, which means that by extension we are on the side of Mr. Urden.
Sides are irrelevant. We have to find that baby, Eggman said.
I completely agree, but what?
Eggman said. We find the baby, and we find out how Ariadne Sava died. That's all that matters.
He leaned on her desk. Madam, Ariadne's father will be here tomorrow. The man has lost his daughter. If I can't put his grandchild in his arms...
Jekyll sighed. Eggman, we've been through Sultan Ahmed, and we've found nothing. How far do you think this infant has travelled? And how realistic is it to think you'll put the child in its grandfather's arms? Whoever killed the woman, if she was killed by someone, probably killed the child too.
Then why wasn't it with its mother?
I have no idea.
I only have theories, Eggman said, one of which is that the killer was the child's father.
The room went quiet for a moment.
We don't know who got Ariadne pregnant, Eggman said. She kept that a secret, and nobody has come forward to say they were her lover. Assuming he didn't kill her, why not?
Because that person might be married, Dekker suggested.
Or embarrassed, Eggman said. Ariadne moved in limited circles, madam. The men in her life were few. But Urden, albeit as an enemy, was one of them, and so I need to speak to him. And I need to do that as soon as possible, and without, if I can, being subjected to a load of arrogant point-scoring and rank-pulling.
She looked up at him. I'll do what I can.
And then she told them both to go.
Eggman, with Gursel in tow, marched down to the station car park and lit a cigarette.
Once he'd calmed down enough to speak, he said, You know, Kirim, Mr. Urden's refusal to see me has really made me suspicious. I know in all probability he's just asserting himself over me for his own pleasure, but I'm finding it hard to shake the idea that something else is going on, too.
Chapter 4 They watched, Suleiman leaning against a lamppost, smoking, while Umer Mungun ate a corn cob. They could have been any two businessmen taking a break from their office, in stark contrast to the uniformed robocops stalking the park and the people who continued to gather there. They were also much more invisible than the two undercover officers Suleiman had spotted in the crowd. He tipped his head at one of them. "Him," he said. "See? Looks like a refugee from San Francisco in the 1960s.
"Sir?"
"He looks like an old hippie," Suleiman explained. "It's too much. You see any other men wearing flowers and dancing to a tune in their own head?" "And her?" He waved a hand towards a girl wearing a long dress and smoking what looked like a joint. "If that's cannabis she's puffing, I'm a Persian."
"No smell," Umar said. "We'd smell dope from here, and she'd be stoned.
I'm surprised the people around her haven't noticed. She might as well have cop written in neon above her head."
They were standing at the end of Istiqlal Jadisi, casually and unofficially, looking at a scene that was, so far, quiet and colourful. The weather was warm, people sat outside tents, some playing flutes or recorders, while pretty girls walked past holding rainbow flags in support of lesbians, gays, bisexual and transgendered citizens. There was a tension that could sometimes be seen on the faces of some of the younger men, but in general the atmosphere was calm. An older man, walking hand in hand with a woman, held up a placard which said, "Architects say no to Taksim redevelopment."
"Do you think we might have to get directly involved in this, sir?"
Umar asked, once he finished his corn. "It should be unlikely, but I don't know," Suleiman said. "If this protest grows, then we'll be involved, whether we like it or not. The whole city will be." Umar wanted to ask his superior what he thought about the protest, but he didn't. Officially, they both had a duty to uphold the rule of law, which protests of any sort clearly threatened. He surmised that Suleiman didn't like the idea of the Ottoman-style shopping mall, which was meant to replace the park. He knew he hated the new faux-Ottoman housing developments that had been built all over the city in the last few years, because he'd said so. He was, after all, the real thing,
grandson of an Ottoman prince and scion of one of the old empire's most prestigious dynasties, Mehmet Suleiman came from old money. He had real class, which even a country boy like Omer could see. He'd met his boss's parents once, living in genteel poverty in Arnavutköy. The old woman had looked heartbreakingly sad, while the old man, who had dementia, talked to himself in French about his father's eunuchs and the family's long-dead Greek physician. Suleiman put his cigarette out. "Well, Omer, let's go and see these bones." An incomplete skeleton had been found in the grounds of the Galatasaray Lisesi, one of the most prestigious schools in Turkey. Housed in a large 19th-century building on İstiklal Caddesi, it was also Suleiman's old alma mater. He began walking. "I think it's probably a job for the archaeologist, but I imagine the students must be excited," he said. Omer followed him, silently wondering whether Suleiman was going to meet up with any of his old teachers. Sitting outside, when the weather was warm, was one of the few real pleasures Anastasia Negroponte had felt. 87 years of life had stripped most of the meat from her bones, and even her wonderful black hair, which had retained its colour until her 70s, had now turned white. From the street beyond her gates, a young man looked at her as if she was an exhibit in a museum. She knew what he thought. It was the same as most people. That her mind didn't work, that she was an idiot, a living tragedy, only notionally alive. But although her face moved only with difficulty, Anastasia was still there. On days like this, Haka would put her chair in the garden, and she would drink mint tea through a straw, while he, her last remaining servant, tended to the plants. Years before, there had been the cook, too, the driver, Yılmaz, and later on Haka's wife, Sirma, and their two children. But Sirma had died, the children had gone, and the cook, Yılmaz, were just distant memories. Now there was just Haka and Yanis. If she moved her neck as far to the left as she could manage, she could see him standing outside the front gate. With his long legs apart, he looked substantial and, knowing Yanis, a little fierce. But he'd be useless against a bulldozer. Anastasia looked away. Seeing that Haka was watching her, she called him over. He bent low so that he could hear her. Between her weak voice and his poor hearing, communication was not always easy.
Yanni, come inside, she said.
Her own voice had irritated her for over 50 years. She still wasn't used to it. Haka bowed.
"Yes, Madame Anastasia," he said.
He left some sort of flower on her table when he went. It was red and round, but she didn't know what it was. She couldn't remember. Apart from those things she could never forget, her memory was random. In that sense, she was an idiot. But the passers-by she sometimes heard who said that she didn't know who she was were wrong. Anastasia Negroponte knew exactly who she was. She knew where she lived, because her ancestors had lived in the same place for over 1,000 years, and she also knew that she was in danger of losing it all. And Anastasia Negroponte, for all her age and her disabilities, was not about to let that happen.
"Mr. Ahmed Erden?" Igmen held his police ID up to the window of Erden's Range Rover Evoque. Erden leaned his head out and took off his dark glasses. Igmen smiled. "Inspector Çetin Igmen," he said. "I tried to contact you at your home yesterday, but you were out."
"I'm out now," Erden said. "What do you want? How did you find me?"
Igmen hadn't waited for Commissioner Tekker to gently ask Ahmet Erden for an appointment. Having Kerim stake out his house from early that morning had been much more effective. And they'd ended up almost on Igmen's doorstep, in Sultan Ahmet.
"I need to speak to you about a woman called Ariadne Sava," Igmen said. "She was an archaeologist up at the museum, and she that woman who's died."
"She is dead, yes, sir," Igmen said.
Ahmed Erden had kept his engine running ever since Eichmann had first seen his car pull up in front of the old Negroponte mansion. People like him often claimed to be green, but if this behavior was anything to go by, then conspicuous consumption was probably more his thing. Eichmann didn't like it, but he made himself ignore it. "We're trying to trace all Dr. Sava's contacts in the city," he continued, "of which I believe you were one, Mr. Erden."
"Why would I know an archaeologist?"
Eichmann lit a cigarette. He saw Erden bridle. "Do you have to do that, Inspector?" he said. Eichmann smiled. "No law, as yet, against it, out in the open air, sir," he said. "Now about Dr. Sava, I believe you knew her, due to her philanthropic activities with the rubbish pickers in the Gizli Tepe district of Kadikoy."
"A what?"
"Dr. Sava tried to help the rubbish pickers made homeless by your redevelopment in Gizli Tepe."
"Their landlords made them homeless, not me," Erden said. "Carry on saying I did it, and I'll have my lawyer on you."
These modern urban developers liked litigation. Eichmann ignored it. "Back to Dr. Sava."
"Oh, yes, I remember her," Erden said. "Kept on about how I should do something about the rubbish people. I told her what I told you. It's the landlords." "But she wouldn't listen. She had this agenda about the buildings, which I think were more important to her than the people. All this talk about how valuable old filthy buildings are supposed to be. What's that? I build nice modern homes that are clean. Gizli Tepe was just old Gedje Kondu property. What was the point?"
Eichmann wondered where Ahmed Erden wanted him to start. But of course he couldn't. If he got into his stride about preserving the past and the value of traditional neighborhoods, he would never stop. Instead he said, "Whatever Dr. Sava's motives might be, she disagreed with you over the fate of the rubbish pickers."
"Yes?"
"You even threatened her over it." As he watched Erden's face darken, Eichmann added,
"Allegedly." "Who told you I threatened her? I didn't. It was those rubbish pickers, wasn't it?"
He wagged a finger in Eichmann's face. "If you're looking for the woman's killer, then don't come to me. I live my life according to my faith, which means I can't kill." "I never said she was killed."
"Those down-and-outs are drunk most of the time. Anything could have happened when she was with them. I warned her. I didn't threaten her, but I warned her about them."
"What did you think those Dr. Sava only wanted to help might do to her, Mr. Erden?"
"I don't know. What do I know of such people? But I said it would end badly, and it has."
"Not in Gizli Tepe. A body wasn't found there," Eichmann said. "It was actually found here."
"Where?" "In that house,"
he pointed. Eichmann looked over his shoulder. The Negroponte house had all but disappeared behind its old trees and twisting plants in recent years. As a small child, Chetin and his brother, Halal, had often been invited into that garden with their mother, Aisha. Madame Anastasia liked to have her fortune told, and Eichmann's mother had been a well-known witch who read the cards and the coffee grounds. Back then, Anastasia had been a young woman with a young husband who owned a very successful tailoring business on Istiklal Jadisi. The Negropontes were Byzantine Greeks who had been living in the city since it wasn't much more than a village. Even as a small child, Eichmann had found them fascinating. But then, in 1955, they had, along with most of their community, suffered the most horrific violence at the hands of their Turkish neighbors. Anastasia's husband was killed, and she was left brain-damaged. A newly born child suffered another fate, depending upon whose story one believed.
"Why do you ask about that house?" Eichmann said. "I have an interest in it," Erden said.
Eichmann felt the back of his neck tingle. Although he would never have described himself as a witch, like his mother, he had inherited a sensitivity to what people said and did, and what it might mean. Some of his colleagues called it second sight. He just accepted it was what it was.
"And that interest is none of your business," Erden said. "Was the foreign woman's body found in that house or not?"
If you'd read whatever paper you take yesterday, you would have seen that the body of a woman was found in the ruins at the back of the Hippodrome, Hickman said. So, no. A short walk from here, but not here.
I can't help with this, Erdin said. He got out of his car.
Two men Eggman hadn't noticed before walked towards him.
I've got work to do. As I said before, if you want to know who killed that woman, go and speak to those drunken rubbish pickers.
Sir, Eggman put a hand on Erdin's arm and felt him cringe.
Don't touch me.
The two men with him didn't look as if they approved either. Eggman took his hand away. For legal reasons, you will have to make a statement about your involvement with Ariadne Saba, even if we do have to make an appointment with you to do it, he said.
Erdin shrugged. Then do it. Call my office in Üsküdar. Make your appointment and then come and see what a modern friend of the people looks like. You know they call my offices the soup kitchen over there because I feed all of Üsküdar's good poor people.
Briefly he moved in close to Eggman. Don't take that foreign woman's word over mine, he said.
I do everything I can for the needy in this city. Everything.
Then he and his companions walked away. Eggman wondered what, if anything, Mr. Erdin did for the bad poor of Üsküdar. He was about to leave and go back to the station, but he saw Erdin knock on the great gates outside the Negroponte's house, and he was intrigued. He heard him call out,
Yanis!
But no one answered him, and so he called again. When no reply was forthcoming this time, one of Erdin's men tried the door, but it was locked. The three of them stood around talking for a while, and then they moved off, but not back to their cars. Erdin wanted the house. Alone now, Eggman couldn't think of any other business he might wish to do with Anastasia, her servant, and the man alleged to be her son. Yanis Negroponte, a baby barely 3 months old, had disappeared in the anti-Greek riots of September 1955. Everyone had assumed he had died, but then in 1997 a 42-year-old man had arrived at the Negroponte house claiming to be Yanis. He'd come with a story about being rescued from the back of the Negroponte shop in Biolu by a childless Turkish woman. She and her husband had taken him with them when they moved to Germany for work, which was why, when he'd arrived, he'd had such a strong German accent. That had been the story, but few people had accepted it, except for Anastasia Negroponte. Whether her old servant Hacke believed Yanis was genuine was not known. A dour man in his mid-80s, he, like his mistress, rarely left the house. Yanis, on the other hand, was often out. He liked to entertain with magic tricks and would troll the streets, the tea gardens and coffee houses for an audience. He was an odd man, whoever he was. Eggman looked at the house and lit another cigarette. If Ahmet Erdin was trying to buy the Negroponte house, he wondered whether he was doing so at Yanis's behest. Anastasia was as old as wood and would die soon, and the site had to be worth a fortune. Yanis wasn't a young man, but he could still have a very comfortable life if he cashed in his mother's property. And, at least since he'd moved into the Negroponte house, he'd not had a comfortable life, locked in with only the old woman and her retainer for company. Even back in the 1950s, when Eggman used to go to the house as a child, the place had been damp, and he still remembered their old storerooms with a shudder. Spiders as big as his hand had clambered over the Negroponte's wine racks, and there were spooky arches, blackened with age, which dripped with stale-smelling water. Much as he'd always loved going there, Eggman had sometimes suffered nightmares over that house when he was young. The skeleton, which was very dark brown, was hidden from view. Attached to the palm tree underneath which the body had been found, a tent concealed Dr. Artur Sarkisian and his many instruments of investigation. One of the lycée's students had found what he had thought to be a joke skeleton hand coming out of the ground by the tree. It was only when one of his teachers took it away from him, when he was playing with it in class, that further investigations had been made. The hand had been part of a whole skeleton that had been entwined around the roots of the palm tree.
Doctor?
Sarkisian looked up.
Ah, Inspector Suleiman, he said.
He nodded at Ömer Mungun.
Sergeant? So tell me about it,
Suleiman said. The doctor crossed his arms.
Well, our body is that of a man. He has some quite elaborate dental work in his mouth, and so it's reasonable to deduce that he wasn't poor. He's adult, but I can't tell how old yet. I don't know how he died. What I can say with some certainty, though, is that even if he died unlawfully, that happened a long time ago.
What do you mean by a long time?
Decades, he said. Look at how degraded the skeleton is.
If it's so old, why wasn't it discovered before? Ömer Mungun asked.
There can be various reasons, the doctor said. But mainly it's because the earth beneath our feet, much as we don't like to think about it, is very rarely static.
Even if we didn't live on a seismic fault, this would be the case.
But because Istanbul is in an area of earthquake activity, this phenomenon is even more pronounced. He just rose to the surface one day, enmeshed in palm roots.
Suleiman moved closer to the skeleton.
Have they damaged it?
Not much, no. Palm roots are not as deep or as hardy as, say, mature olive roots. It's time that has caused the most damage. He died a long time ago. I've called a friend to help me determine when that might have been.
Who's that?
Dr. Agyildiz. She's one of our few archaeological pathologists. Although I may well be able to determine this man's age and how he died, she is more expert than I at pinpointing when. For all I know, he could have been here for 20 years or 70.
Suleiman nodded.
Okay. We've already had the press sniffing around, the doctor said. I believe at least one of the students at the Lisa has a media mogul in the family. So this will be in the papers and on the TV news. But do I think this is a job for the police? No. If our friend here was poisoned with strychnine 60 years ago, there's no need for urgency.
Unless his killer is still alive, Suleiman said. The doctor shrugged.
I'll let you know as soon as Dr. Ayyadaz and myself have got any news.
Suleiman sighed.
And in the meantime, I will have to tell the commissioner...
What?
Tell her that we found an historical skeleton in the grounds of the Galatasaray Lycée, cause of death unknown,
Sarkisian said.
In all seriousness, this is a story that will soon get lost in today's climate. Have you been up to Gezi Park?
Yes, Suleiman said. All quiet.
For now?
You think it's going to kick off again, Doctor?
Ömer Mungun asked.
The Armenian looked down at the ground.
I do.
Any particular reason? Suleiman asked.
For a moment the doctor said nothing.
Then he leaned towards the two officers.
People can't take much more redevelopment. You know what I mean? I know you know Talabasha neighborhood, Inspector.
Suleiman and Mungun had worked on a case in that area the year before. It was where Gonca's father had lived.
The poor move out of picturesque slums. The developers knock the slums down and build hideous tower blocks, which the rich move into. The poor live on the streets, because they've nowhere else to go.
It's like this in every major European city. It's the free market economy, Suleiman said.
It's wrong, Sarkisian said.
His red face showed his passion.
Those people in the park know it. And so do all the thousands who will join them.
Suleiman shifted uncomfortably from one foot to the other.
We'll see. Now, Doctor, do you have any idea when you and your colleague will be able to tell us more about this skeleton?
Clearly any sharing of opinions about Gezi Park was over. Sarkisian cleared his throat.
3 days, maybe less. 3 to be on the safe side.
Good. By the time Suleiman and Mungun left through the vast metal school gates, Istiklal Caddesi was full of young people wearing face paint and brightly coloured hats. They carried banners that had slogans on them saying, "Hands off Gezi Park," and "Another shopping mall, no thanks."
I used to sometimes get out of school at lunchtime and buy kukuric from a stall in the Balik Pazar,
Suleiman said.
That was before Istiklal was pedestrianised.
I can't tell you how thick with fumes the air was.
He lit a cigarette.
This street has changed a lot over the years. Not all of it for the better.
It's good the fumes have gone, sir, Omer said.
Oh, yes, they were bad, Suleiman said. But the boy he used to sell me the cockroach my parents so disapproved of. I wish he was still in business.
Why isn't he, sir?
Suleiman took a deep drag from his cigarette. Because he fell through the cracks, Omer. He lost his home to the developers. His wife took his children away to live with her parents in Mersin. Working is difficult if you're homeless. He slept underneath his stall for months, until it all got too much for him. One night he drank half a bottle of cognac, and then cut his own throat.
Chapter 5
Çetin! Çetin!
Hans grabbed at his pajama top. It was dark, and he was disorientated.
Juan, he's only just come in. Kemal!
Kemal? Igman turned his head to look at his bedside clock. It's 4:30, he said. In the morning.
Yes, yes, and that boy has only just got in.
He's not a boy. He's 21.
His wife, Fatma, put her bedside lamp on.
God!
Igman screwed up his eyes and buried his face in his pillow.
When I was 21, I had a son of my own and another one on the way. He's a man.
Fatma Igman shook her long grey hair.
In law, he may be, she said, but you know how silly he can be. Easily led. He'll have been up to that park in Biyolu.
She pushed her husband to the edge of the bed.
Go and talk to him.
Igman swung his legs down on the floor and stood up. He felt groggy and his mouth tasted indescribable.
Go on.
He walked to the bedroom door.
Only if you don't follow and keep putting your contribution in. If you want me to talk to Kemal, then I will, but not with you censoring me.
I won't.
Make sure you don't, he said.
Pausing only to find a cigarette in his jacket pocket and then light it, Igman knocked on his son's bedroom door. The youngest of the 9 Igman children, Kemal was the only one still living at home.
Kemal?
There was no answer. Igman didn't know when the boy had got in, but it couldn't have been long before.
Kemal?
There was a sort of snorting sound, and then a voice said,
What is it?
Igman opened the door to a room he didn't want to illuminate. Even in the dark he could see that it was a chaos of clothes, books, computers, and dirty tea glasses. Something in the middle of the mess reared up.
What do you want, Dad?
Your mother says I'm to tell you not to go to Gezi Park, Igman said. Have you been to Gezi Park, Kemal? Tell me the truth. There was a pause, and then Kemal said,
Yes, and I'm going to go tomorrow, too. I haven't got any lectures, so why not? Why? Going to try and stop me?
No, Igman said. On the contrary, I applaud your commitment.
So why are you telling me off?
I'm not, but your mother's worried. She asked me to speak to you, so I'm speaking.
I don't understand. Do you want me to go to Gezi or not?
I want you to do what your conscience tells you to do, whilst keeping safe and avoiding confrontation. And I want you to call me, and most definitely not your mother, if anything goes wrong.
Dad, are you saying that you support what people are protesting about in Gezi?
There was a pause before Igman spoke.
My job is to uphold the law and protect the people of this city from harm. My opinions don't matter. Things that do matter are people's lives, their homes, and their liberty. So you do. I support no one, he said. And I support everyone. Policemen are not supposed to be political. Now, go to sleep and remember what I told you. Oh, and try not to be so late next time, Kemal. Your mother is a trial when you're out beyond 1 a.m.
Okay.
Igman left the boy, finished his cigarette, and then went back to bed. Fatma was sitting up, knitting, nervously. One of their daughters, Gül,
had just had her first baby, and Fatma was producing whole new woolen wardrobes for it every week.
"Well," she said, "had he been to the park?"
Igmen got into bed beside her.
"He had." "Well, did you tell him not to?"
Igmen lay down. "I told him to be careful and not to come home so late," he said.
"But did you tell him not to go to that park?"
He looked her in the eyes.
"No, I didn't."
"Why?" "Yes, Fatma, I know what you told me to tell him," he said. "But I couldn't do that, and you shouldn't have asked me."
"But you went to shut you up."
"Yes," he said. He put a hand on her arm. She didn't pull away. "Fatma, you know that I love you more than life. You know, I hope, that I respect the way you live the religious life with every part of your being. I know that..."
"Chitin, I don't want another shopping mall to be built where Gezi Park is," she interrupted. "Just because some of the people who do want it are religious too, doesn't mean I have to agree with them. I just don't want Kemal to get hurt. Some of your colleagues in the park have been zealous."
"Bastards," he said. "Don't get me started." He put his arms out to her. "Come on, we need to sleep." Fatma put her knitting down beside the bed and slid down into his embrace.
"Oh, Chitin,"
she said. "If anything were to happen to Kemal, I'd never forgive myself." "For what?"
"Being his mother."
He hugged her.
"You know.
Just look after him, Chitin.
Do that for me."
"I will have as many eyes trained in Kemal's direction as I can," Igmet said. And then he kissed her.
"Don't worry."
Fatma closed her eyes, and soon she was asleep. But Chitin was awake now, and thinking about Ariadne Sava and her unknown lost child. Where was it? Hospitals and doctors' surgeries in every part of the city had been contacted. It was all over the media. There had even been yet another press conference. Every day he saw hundreds of people walking along holding small babies or pushing them in prams. At the very periphery of his consciousness, most of the time, they passed him by like ghosts. It could be any one of them, or none. And had Ariadne even known she was pregnant? Nobody around her seemed to have noticed her expanding girth very much. But had that included Ariadne herself? Had her first intimation of pregnancy been as she was passing the hippodrome? Had labor pains forced her to hide herself away in the Svendon? But there had been so little blood there. And wouldn't she rather have got help? Or did she maybe think that the Turks wouldn't help her? Surely she lived in the city long enough to know that was very unlikely. But then whether she knew she was pregnant or not wasn't really the point. Who, if anyone, had killed her and may have taken her baby, was. Mehmet Suleiman walked down the hill to where he parked his car. He'd hardly slept, but not because he was having passionate sex with Gunja. At almost midnight, large sections of her extended family had arrived at the house. He had recognized three of her brothers, a sister, and her eldest son, but all the others had been unknown to him. A colorful mob, passing around bottles of cognac and rakı, they had settled themselves into Gunja's studio and then talked at the tops of their voices until dawn. He'd gone to bed, but their noise had kept him awake. And when they had finally gone and Gunja had joined him in bed, she'd had the temerity to ask him why he was still awake. Noise didn't seem to affect gypsies. Why was that? And now he knew all their business. They'd all got together to talk about what had been going on in Gezi Park, who they knew was taking part, and how they could maybe use the protest to draw attention to the way their traditional neighborhoods had been developed. There had been a lot of talk about the police. None of the gypsies so much as hinted at any fear of the authorities. Rather, they expressed their anxieties through their fears for others. One had said, "The people they beat are like the hippies from the 1960s, peace lovers. They just let them kick them." "And transsexuals," another said, "pulling their hair and shouting filthy insults at them." An old voice put in, "All the transsexuals I know carry weapons. None of them would hesitate to defend their honor.
What kind of weak transsexuals did you see, Mateen?
People had laughed, and then there had been more drinking. They'd all wanted to go to Gezi Park, and that had included Gonja. But in the end, the young people were chosen. Some nephews and nieces, students who would blend with the crowd. Suleiman passed a heavily bearded man and his wife, whose face was covered by a niqab. Beyond the Greek school, over the hill, was the district of Chashamba, where a lot of pious Muslims like this couple lived. Suleiman was not convinced that outward appearance necessarily reflected inner piety, but he didn't know how else to describe such people. In the very earliest days of the 21st century, some artists, young intellectuals, and gypsies had moved into the Fener Balat area with the idea that they'd build a vibrant community of like-minded people. To an extent, that had happened, but the pious presented what, to Gonja at least, felt like a dour presence. She talked about them looking down their noses at those who were not like them, and mouthing bad words at her daughters. Suleiman didn't know whether they did such things or not. The people who had complained about his relationship with Gonja were much less obvious than the men and women of Chashamba. They were his colleagues, anonymous and hidden in the vastness of the department. They could be anyone. They could even be someone he knew well. The only thing he did know was that it couldn't be Igmen or Ömer Mungun. If Igmen had a problem with Gonja, he would have told Suleiman to his face. But he liked the gypsy, who was closer to Igmen's age than Suleiman's. And Ömer Mungun wasn't going to draw attention to himself, unless he had to. Suleiman opened his car door with his remote control. As the BMW bleeped in response, some children who were picking through rubbish on the pavement ran up to him and asked for money. He gave them 1 lira each, then got in his car and drove away. When Yanis pulled the cotton thread he'd put in his mouth out of his eye, all the children screamed and pulled faces. One little girl held her baby brother up high so he could see, but he was so young he could barely focus. "There, you see, magic," Yanis said. "Anyone want to see a kitten come out of this box?"
"Yeah, I do, but my mum says you're evil,"
one boy said. Yanis Negroponte put the small box on the ground in front of him, and then covered it with a silk scarf.
"Oh, why does your mum say that?" "Because magic is evil," the boy said. "Where'd your mum get that from?"
The boy shrugged.
A girl said, "Kitten! Come on, let's see the kitten!"
Yanis waved a thin, dark hand over the silk scarf and mumbled some words the children strained to hear but couldn't. There was a pause. Then he flicked the scarf away to reveal a tiny black kitten.
"Ah!"
The girl with the baby brother said,
"Can I have it?"
Yanis picked the kitten up. "No," he said, "but you can stroke him if you like." The children treated the kitten gently, even the boys. The sons and daughters of shopkeepers and pension owners, they were not street urchins who had little regard for animals, or rich kids who found anything not on a computer screen boring. These kids were the ideal audience, and Yanis made a point of always having some new tricks for them whenever they gathered outside the gates of the Negroponte house. Once all the children had stroked the kitten, Yanis said that was the end of the show for the day, and went back through his gates. Arka was in the garden, and Yanis gave him the kitten as he passed. "He can go back to his mother now," he said.
"As you wish."
Yanis walked into the house via the French windows. Anastasia was asleep on one of the couches in front of the television, which was blaring out football scores. He turned it off, but she didn't wake. Then he looked at her. In sleep, she looked almost serene, but he knew she couldn't be. Peace of mind, under the circumstances, was impossible for any of them. He looked again at the figure Ahmet Erden had offered him for the house. He'd written it down on the back of one of his business cards. At the time, Yanis had just shoved it in his pocket. Now he looked at it, and wondered how the man had the gall to think they'd even consider such an insulting sum. But then Erden could afford gall. He had never, and would never, pay the going rate for the land he developed. Mostly he bought from the poor and ignorant, or from people who would get some sort of kickback once he'd built his tower blocks.
Erdin had made it abundantly clear to Yanis that he was doing an old Byzantine family, who were a bit strapped for cash, a big favor. What he didn't know was that there